The Katra Podcast, Conversations for the Curious, Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome, curious listeners. Today we're diving deep into a really powerful book, Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimed, on not getting by in America. It's quite something.
It really is a landmark piece of immersive journalism.
Absolutely. And this book, it's not just, you know, her story of a few tough months. It's structured like an experiment, really, trying to answer one big question.
Can someone without, say, special skills or savings actually make it? Survive, pay the bills on the kind of minimum wage jobs available in America?
Right. And that question feels, well, incredibly relevant today, maybe even more so now than when it first came out.
Definitely. Nickel and Dimed is such a strong counterpoint to that persistent idea, you know, the myth that just working hard is enough to escape poverty.
It came out right when those big welfare to work reforms were happening.
Exactly. Reforms based on this, well, frankly, assumption that any job would lead to self-sufficiency. Ehrenreich wasn't buying the political talk. She wanted proof.
Yeah, she wanted to see the reality on the ground.
And what she found, what she exposed, was the systemic side of it. The low pay, the high costs, this huge gap between the rhetoric about pulling yourself up and the actual brutal financial reality for millions.
So let's talk about the person behind this mission, Barbara Ehrenreich. She passed in 2022, but she had this really interesting background. A well-known journalist, a social critic, but also
a PhD.
Yeah.
In cellular immunology from Rockefeller University, no less. Which seems kind of unexpected, right?
It does, but you argue that science background was key?
I think so. It gave her social criticism, this real analytical edge. She wasn't just relying on passion, though she had plenty of that. She approached this like a scientist, looking for data, for evidence.
Measuring the failure points in the system itself.
Precisely. She wasn't just observing poverty. She was trying to understand the mechanics of it.
And her commitment, deciding to actually live it, leaving her middle-class life behind, temporarily anyway, her network, her credentials.
That's what makes it so powerful. It's the ultimate participatory journalism. She wasn't just analyzing poverty from afar. She was experiencing the visceral day-to-day struggle, bridging that gap between theory and lived reality.
Okay, so setting up the experiment in the late 90s, responding to those welfare debates. She had rules, right? Very strict rules.
Yeah, super important for the credibility. Mm-hmm. The idea was, okay, if someone had to go from welfare straight into a low-wage job, what would that actually look like?
So rule one, No using her education or her real identity.
Right. Rule two, always take the highest-paying low-wage job she was offered. No being picky.
And rule three, find housing she could actually truly afford on those wages.
Yes, and she gave herself a small cushion, about $1,300, just for that first month's setup costs, deposits, you know, before the paychecks started rolling in.
And the conclusion she reaches from all this, it's pretty stark, isn't it?
It really is. Her main thesis becomes unavoidable. Poverty isn't about laziness or lack of motivation. It's a trap. A systemic one.
The wages are too low, the costs, especially housing, are too high.
And the labor practices are often exploitative, designed to keep workers insecure. It's this kind of cruel combination.
Something else that's really important to mention up front, the advantages she did have.
Oh, absolutely crucial. She makes a point of this. She was healthy, she was white, a native English speaker, and importantly, she didn't have kids or dependents relying on her.
Which implies?
Well, it implies that if she, with all those advantages, couldn't make it work, couldn't escape the cycle, then the situation for her coworkers, who often lack those advantages, must be astronomically harder, maybe even impossible.
Okay, let's follow her journey. She tries out different cities, different jobs. First stop, Key West, Florida. Restaurant work, right? A waitress?
Yeah, dives right into that fast-paced, often chaotic world. And the first big discovery.
It hits her almost immediately, doesn't it? The math just doesn't work.
Exactly. The simple, brutal arithmetic. Even when she combined her hourly wage and her tips, it wasn't enough to cover the basic cost of living there, especially in a tourist town.
You gave an example earlier, like if she's making $7 an hour.
Right. Think about needing, say, $800 for a deposit and first month's rent on a basic apartment. That's over 200 hours of work just for rent. Before you even think about food, transportation, anything else, the numbers just don't add up.
And it wasn't just the money, was it? She talks a lot about the physical side.
Oh, yeah. The constant pain, the sheer exhaustion, and that emotional labor, too, having to be on, cheerful,
right,
friendly, even when you're physically and mentally drained. It's incredibly taxing.
Housing was the immediate massive problem.
Huge hurdle. She ends up in this rundown trailer far from town, which of course creates another problem.
Transportation costs, another drain on already tight finances.
Right. And this is where she meets Gail, a coworker who's actually living in her van.
That must have been incredibly difficult, ethically. Observing someone like Gail, knowing she could technically help, but couldn't break the experiment's rules.
She talks about that tension. It was a conscious choice to maintain the experiment's integrity, but seeing people like Gail working constantly, yet homeless, really brought home the cruelty of the system.
So Key West proves unsustainable. She adjusts, moves north, Portland, Maine, different kind of work.
Yes, she tries house cleaning, joins a big chain, the maids, maybe hoping for something less frantic than waitressing.
But it came with its own set of challenges.
Definitely. Still incredibly physically demanding, but also exposure to harsh cleaning chemicals day in, day out, and this real sense of isolation and visibility. Domestic work often feels like that.
And she describes the management style there. Ted, the manager.
Yeah, it highlights that corporate control aspect. Very focused on rigid rules, efficiency, surveillance. Workers treated almost like interchangeable parts, their health secondary to the schedule.
Even taking a second job as a dietary aide in a nursing home, she still couldn't make ends meet consistently. Still struggling. Even with two jobs, she couldn't quite stabilize financially in Maine.
Which leads her to the final stop, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And this time, it's retail. Walmart.
Right. And this section is really key because she digs into the more sophisticated ways corporations control their workforce. It's not just low wages.
She talks about the orientation process.
Lengthy orientations filled with anti-union messages, mandatory drug tests, constant monitoring, psychological tactics to ensure compliance. It's very strategic.
And the scheduling.
That's a huge part of the exploitation. Deliberately keeping people just under full-time hours to avoid paying benefits like health insurance. And the schedules are often erratic, unpredictable.
Which makes it almost impossible to hold down a second job reliably or arrange childcare, right?
Exactly. It keeps workers dependent and insecure. And ultimately, the outcome in Minneapolis is the same. Even working hard at Walmart, finding stable, affordable housing on that single income, still out of reach.
So she has to conclude the experiment, essentially, in failure.
Yeah.
And that failure is the point. It's the synthesis of the whole book. Ehrenreich shows the low-wage economy isn't a stepping stone. It's often a trap.
A system where employer power and artificially low wages just keep people stuck no matter how hard they work.
Precisely. Effort and motivation become almost irrelevant against those structural barriers.
Okay, let's pull back and look at the big themes here. You mentioned the first one already.
Yeah.
The mathematical impossibility.
Yeah, that's the foundation. The book just lays out the cold, hard numbers. Minimum wage, even sometimes slightly above, simply cannot cover basic living costs, especially rent in most places.
Rent taking up 70, 80% of your income?
Leaves zero margin for error. A car repair, a toothache, a sick day. Any small crisis can spiral into disaster. Homelessness, hunger. It's that precarious.
Which leads right into that second theme you mentioned, the hidden costs of being poor. The poverty trap.
It's such a cruel irony, isn't it? People with the least money often end up paying more for basic necessities. Well, like the housing example. Can't afford the big deposit for an apartment lease, you end up paying much higher weekly rates at a budget motel. No time or kitchen facilities to cook. You rely on expensive, less healthy fast food, can't afford preventative doctor visits or take time off.
You end up in the emergency room later with a much bigger bill and bigger problem.
Exactly. Being poor is incredibly expensive in ways we don't always see.
And then there's the theme of dehumanization in service work, how workers are made to feel invisible.
Yeah, stripped of dignity. Autonomy, subject to constant surveillance, forced smiles, scripted interactions, treated like cogs in a machine.
This idea that the work is unskilled.
It's a label used to justify the low pay and poor treatment, isn't it? It's not an accurate description of the work itself. It's a social construct that allows the exploitation to continue. It devalues the worker, makes her struggles seem somehow acceptable.
Which connects to some really powerful quotes in the book, lines that just stick with you.
Oh, absolutely. She has a way of phrasing things that really reframes the whole debate.
What's one that really stands out?
For me, it's this one. The working poor, as they are approvingly termed, are in fact the major philanthropists of our society.
Wow. Explain that. What does she mean by philanthropists?
She means their low wages effectively subsidize the comfortable lifestyles of everyone else. The cheap meals, the low prices we enjoy, they're possible because these workers are sacrificing their own well-being, their time, their ability to live decently. They're essentially gifting part of their lives so the rest of us can have things cheaper.
That's a powerful way to put it. A real challenge.
It is. And another key one challenges that unskilled label directly. No job, no matter how lowly, is truly unskilled.
Because all jobs require something, right?
Exactly. Whether it's remembering complex orders under pressure, handling difficult customers with grace, operating machinery safely, cleaning meticulously. It all requires skill, concentration, often immense physical and emotional effort. Unskilled is just a convenient excuse for low pay.
And the final quote you mentioned, the direct moral challenge.
Yeah. When someone works for less pay than she can live on, then she has made a great sacrifice for you. She has made you a gift of some part of her life.
That really forces you, the reader, to confront your own role in the system, your own benefit from it.
It does. It shifts it from an abstract economic issue to a direct moral relationship between the consumer and the worker, whose dignity might be compromised for that convenience or low price.
So, knowing all this, how do we apply it? What are the takeaways for us listening right now, on a personal level, maybe?
Well, the most immediate thing is just basic human respect and empathy. Seeing service workers, acknowledging them.
And practically.
Tipping generously is obvious, but also patience. Understanding when someone seems stressed or rushed. Mm-hmm. And maybe thinking more consciously about our choices as consumers.
Like, if something seems suspiciously cheap.
Asking why. Who is paying the real price for that bargain? Maybe choosing to support businesses known for treating their workers better, even if it costs a bit more. It's like voting with your wallet in a small way.
We often hear that argument, though, that minimum wage jobs are starter jobs for teenagers.
Right, the burger flipping teen myth. Ehrenreich just demolishes that. Every single person she worked alongside was an adult trying to survive, often supporting families. Gail living in her van wasn't a teenager saving for a car.
These are essential workers, adults holding up huge sectors of the economy.
Absolutely. And treating them like temporary disposable labor creates this fundamental instability. Yep. It's not just bad for them, it's bad for society.
Okay, so beyond personal actions, what about the bigger picture? Policy, systemic change.
Nickel and Dimed provides powerful ammunition for that. It shifts the focus from charity, let's help the poor, to economic justice.
Meaning
advocating for policies like a genuine living wage, not just a minimum wage, expanding access to affordable housing, strengthening protections for workers, supporting their right to organize.
And she even makes a business case, doesn't she? That treating workers better isn't just nice, it's smart.
Yeah, she shows how the constant turnover caused by low wages and bad conditions is actually really inefficient for businesses. Investing in workers' better pay, predictable schedules, respect leads to lower turnover, higher morale, better performance. Dignity is actually good for the bottom line.
So if there's one final takeaway, one big shift in thinking this book pushes for, what is it?
It's forcing us to ask a different question. Instead of asking why are those people poor or judging their choices,
we should be asking,
what is it about our economic system, our policies, our corporate practices, our cultural assumptions? What is it that creates and maintains this level of poverty, especially for people doing essential work? The book makes the invisible visible. You can't unsee it once you've read it.
What really stuck with me amidst all the hardship were those small moments of connection she describes. The solidarity among coworkers.
Yes, like Gail, Melissa, Holly.
Yeah.
Despite the incredible pressure, they found ways to help each other out. Sharing tips, covering shifts, just offering basic human support.
It shows that resilience, that human spirit pushing back against a really impersonal and often cruel system.
Exactly, that cooperation in the face of adversity is powerful. It underscores that the failure isn't individual, it's structural.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.